Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Francis Boyle, a professor of international law at the University of Illinois, who examines the veracity of the Obama administration's claim that the Syrian government's alleged use of chemical weapons justifies an American military attack. Jennifer Lowenstein of the Middle East Studies program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who talks about what the American people should know about Syria and the possible unintended consequences of U.S. intervention in Syria's civil war. And Garrett Serrells, an activist with the group Kids vs. Global Warming, who talks about his role as a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the federal government over its failure to take action on climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Hilder Pereira is an unemployed 21-year-old construction worker in the suburbs of Paris. He doesn't have a high school degree and is living off unemployment benefits after spending down his savings. In his town of Sevran, France, youth unemployment is over 40%. A continent away on the outskirts of Cape Town, South Africa, Nakona, a mother of two young children, has been out of work for 3 years after being laid off by an office cleaning service. She now gets aid from Dreamworker, a local nonprofit, to improve her job interview skills. Still, the chance of her finding another job is remote, as the unemployment rate for young Black South Africans is over 50%. Across the globe, the International Labor Organization reports 75 million young adults are unemployed. But The Economist magazine claims the ILO's jobless data is vastly underreported. Most of the employment data, especially in emerging economies, does not include women, who are generally not counted as part of the workforce. Young workers were especially hard hit during the 2008 economic crash and the subsequent austerity drive in Europe. Spain, France, and Greece now have some of the highest youth unemployment rates across the globe. In the Amazon jungle of southeastern Colombia, Puinaui Indian Javier Garcia walked 7 hours to pan for rocks containing tungsten, a mineral used by computer companies like Apple, Samsung, and Hewlett-Packard to manufacture cutting-edge electronics. The rocks containing tungsten are located on land controlled by the 50-year-old rebel movement, Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, who uses funds from this valuable commodity to fund its insurgency. Since the mid-1960s, over 250,000 people have been killed in Colombia's civil war. FARC and the Colombian government are now in the midst of peace talks in Havana to end the violence. Negotiations on land rights and political representation have progressed, and a final agreement may be ready by the end of the year. Colombian President Manuel Santos is pressing FARC to cut off its supply of tungsten to global markets. Austrian-based Plan C SE is the largest producer of Colombian tungsten. An investigation by Bloomberg News found two Colombian exporters shipped $1.8 million worth of tungsten ore to a Plan C processing plant in Pennsylvania. Plan C has close ties to the Taiwan-based AU Optics company, which sells liquid crystal displays to both Apple and Samsung. When questioned, the company denied purchasing tungsten from Colombia. Not far from the home of New Jersey mayor and current U.S. Senate candidate Cory Booker, Shanti Hargrove runs a small in-house daycare center for infants and small children. Running the center is hard work, as most of Hargrove's clients are single mothers working in low-wage jobs. Her income depends on the number of small children in her care, mostly from poor African-American families. Across New Jersey, there are over 2,000 in-home daycare service providers. They all work as independent contractors with state agencies, which lack benefits like health care. In 2011, the average child care worker in New Jersey earned just $19,000 a year. Helen Black of the National Women's Law Center observed, "New Jersey pays particularly low rates, some of the worst for infants. It's 38% below the market rate." Now, organizers with New Jersey Communities United are talking with the operators of in-home daycare centers to initiate the founding of a child care workers union. Thus far, 15 states have recognized child care worker unions, which have won bargaining rights for daycare operators. New Jersey daycare operators won their first contract in 2007, which led to a 20% increase in pay and a new grievance procedure. But the contract expired in 2010. Today, Local 1037 of the Communication Workers of America Union is mobilizing daycare providers to win a new contract in alliance with New Jersey Communities United, a successor to ACORN. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Not long after President Obama spoke to the nation about his intention to launch airstrikes against Syria's military in response to Bashar al-Assad's regime's alleged use of chemical weapons resulting in mass civilian casualties, the imminent attack was delayed in order to seek authorization from Congress. The abrupt change was necessitated in part by the defeat of British Prime Minister David Cameron's effort seeking approval from Parliament to join the Americans in future military intervention in Syria. Britain, America's longtime ally's surprising rejection of the planned attack, the defeat of a similar measure in the Arab League, and the all but certain lack of support in the United Nations Security Council forced the Obama administration to seek legitimacy through congressional authorization amidst the palpable skepticism of a war-weary public. Although the administration has received limited support for its planned attack on Syria from France, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and other oil-rich Gulf monarchies, any U.S. military intervention in Syria would be illegal under international law. The United Nations Charter prohibits nations from attacking one another unless the action is undertaken in self-defense or has the approval from the UN Security Council. Your reporter spoke with Francis Boyle, a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law and author of a dozen books on the law in U.S. foreign policy. Here he examines the veracity of the Obama administration's assertion that the Syrian government's alleged use of chemical weapons against its own people justifies an American military attack based on national security and humanitarian grounds.
To make it clear, what Obama is doing now is an act of aggression against Syria, and the UN Charter, for example, the French version that's equally authentic with the English, gives the state a right of self-defense in the event of aggression armée, an armed aggression. So right now, Syria has a right to defend itself if it wants to. Of course, that wouldn't be a very smart thing to do. It would give Obama even more of a pretext to attack Syria. But this is clearly an act of aggression. This is armed aggression. It's lawless violence. I would encourage everyone listening here tonight to do everything they can between now and next week to stop this. As I said, it looks like Syria will be attacked and Lebanon will be attacked, and it could very well degenerate into Iran. I don't know. It also looks like Israel will have a critical role to play, and it will get involved in Turkey. So the whole region could very well go up into flames by the end of next week, at least.
Professor Boyle, when Secretary of State John Kerry or President Obama talk about their plans to bomb the Syrian military, they talk about it in terms of a moral response, a response that's based in a way to stop further death and destruction through the use of chemical weapons. And certainly the videotape that we've seen of the men, women, and children who many of them died in their beds in Syria, according to these videos, it does tug at your heartstring to say that the use of chemical weapons is a horrendous thing, whoever used them. With that in mind, what is the responsibility of the international community in terms of somehow punishing the use of these horrendous weapons? Or is that something that's just beyond the ken of international law?
There are two conventions. There's the Geneva Protocol of 1925 prohibiting the use of chemical weapons in international armed conflict. I wrote a book, if you're interested, called Biowarfare and Terrorism, and also The Future of International Law and American Foreign Policy. we, the United States and the NATO allies, helped give Saddam Hussein chemical weapons that he used against Iran in violation of the Geneva Protocol of 1925, and gassed to death thousands, tens of thousands of Iranians. There is also the Chemical Weapons Convention. Syria is not a party, the U.S. is, but currently we are, the United States, in material breach of the Chemical Weapons Convention. There was an absolute final deadline in the Chemical Weapons Convention that we had to destroy all of our chemical weapons by April of 2012, and we have refused to do it. So those are the two treaties, the Geneva Protocol of 1925. Of course, we grossly violated it in Vietnam with Agent Orange, although technically we were not a party to that treaty until Nixon. And then Nixon gutted it with reservations. So there's so much hypocrisy here on the part of the United States. It's hard to take any of the Obama people seriously. Likewise with biological weapons, even as revealed by the New York Times in their book Germs, the United States government, starting with the second Clinton term, has been going all out to develop biological weapons that are also prohibited by the Geneva Protocol of 1925. We are holding on to our advanced chemical weapons. So that's what we're doing now. So again, this is pure hypocrisy by Obama and his people to say that they're worried about chemical weapons in Syria.
That was Francis Boyle, a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law and author of a dozen books on the law and U.S. foreign policy. For additional analysis and commentary on the Syrian crisis, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After long, bloody, and costly U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the American people are decidedly not looking favorably on President Obama's plan to intervene militarily in Syria's civil war. A Washington Post ABC News poll released on September 3rd found that by a margin of 59% to 36%, Americans oppose a U.S. attack after the Obama administration announced they had high confidence that the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had used chemical weapons against his own people. Opposition to U.S. intervention in Syria was bipartisan, with Democrats and Republicans both coming out equally against the plan that is now being debated in Congress. The president sought and received conditional support in his campaign to win congressional authorization from Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, Mr. Obama's 2008 presidential election opponent. McCain, who was one of President George W. Bush's most vocal supporters of launching the 2003 war against Iraq, has stated his intention to expand U.S. military involvement in Syria beyond President Obama's pledge to limit U.S. intervention to degrade and deter Bashar al-Assad's capacity to use chemical weapons. McCain and other war hawks want the U.S. to reverse the situation on the battlefield and more actively assist rebels in overthrowing the Syrian government. With over 100,000 deaths and 4.5 million internal and external refugees thus far in the Syrian civil war, as well as violence spilling over into neighboring nations, there are many warning signs that U.S. military intervention could trigger unintended and dangerous consequences. Your reporter spoke with Jennifer Lowenstein, Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Here she talks about what the American people should know about Syria and the possible costs of any future U.S. involvement in the Syrian civil war.
In 1982-83, Hafez al-Assad, the former leader of Syria, wiped out the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. He did not want any kind of Islamist threat in Syria, and he was a bloody dictator who wasn't going to negotiate, and as a result, Syria has been, up until very recently, one of the only Arab nations that has not had a so-called threat from Islamist groups. That is one of the reasons that makes the current situation so interesting, I suppose you could say, from an historical standpoint, because now what's happening is that Bashar al-Assad, who is a secularist. He represents Arab nationalism, Arab unity, not Islam, not having an Islamic government, but having an Arab national government, which is something one would think our government would want. That is what he represents. Suddenly, he is faced with an opposition that is, it's not monolithic. There are many different groups within the opposition, but the strongest groups in that opposition are Islamist, are exactly the kinds of groups the United States fears most. They are Salafi groups. They are extremist, fundamentalist, Sunni Islamic groups who want to make or turn Syria into an Islamic state as interpreted in one of the most rigid ways possible. And here is the United States basically, when it comes right down to it, funding these groups. Now, if somebody heard me say that, they would say that's not true. We're funding the liberal opposition, not the Islamist opposition. But the fact of the matter is, even with oversight committees, there is absolutely no way of tracking where our funding or our guns or any kind of humanitarian or non-lethal support is going. And the opposition is fighting amongst itself. The strongest group is the Jabhat al-Nusra, which is an extremist Salafi group. It's the kind of group that is allied with al-Qaeda. And so when people accuse the United States of being on the side of al-Qaeda, there is a grain of truth in it, because they are the ones coming out ahead if we go and strike Syria, if we strike Bashar al-Assad's government and his chemical weapons supply, which I happen to think is a horrible thing. I'm not happy he has chemical weapons. But there are other ways of handling this than militarily, and that's what people don't understand.
Jennifer, as you look at the plan by President Obama, if he gets his congressional approval to move forward with airstrikes in Syrian territory targeting Bashar al-Assad's military, what are the consequences, in your view, internally, in terms of the possible escalation of the fight inside Syria?
It'll become much worse. It'll become worse. Right now, the Syrian government is significantly stronger than the opposition. That is a fact. If the United States goes ahead and strikes the Syrian government, one of the consequences is that it will be weakened, possibly significantly. So you're sort of leveling the playing field. And what is that going to lead to? That's going to lead to more intensive fighting, not only between the opposition and the Ba'athist government of Assad, but among the opposition groups. As I said, there already is a great deal of fighting among the different opposition groups.
The civil war in Syria has spilled over its borders with hundreds of thousands of refugees,
yes.
Millions, in fact, flowing into neighboring countries like Lebanon.
That's
and
right.
Jordan. And there are episodes of violence now in Lebanon we had not seen before. There's unrest in Turkey. What are the consequences in terms of the external reaction if the United States proceeds with a bombing campaign against the Syrian military?
We forget that this is not just a civil war in Syria. So there is a political war in Syria between the opposition and the government. There is a sectarian war in Syria between Sunni and Shia or Alawite. There is a war in Syria in which the United States is fighting Iran. There is the Israeli-Palestinian war playing itself out in Syria. There are Kurdish elements that are playing themselves out in northeastern Syria, around Iraq. In other words, there are half a dozen other conflicts playing out right now in Syria that will almost certainly worsen if we bomb Syria, if we continue to play the card of violence, that we're not going to get anywhere. We're going to go to a much more dangerous, much more violent and volatile place if we offer violence as our answer.
That was Jennifer Lowenstein, Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Find more news and commentary on the Syrian civil war and U.S. military intervention by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent years, young people have been getting more involved in work to halt the warming of the planet. One teenager, Alec Lors, founded a group called Kids vs. Global Warming in 2009 at the age of 13 with his mom, Victoria. Through community engagement campaigns and leadership development programs, the group's goal is to empower youth to speak up for their generation and ignite change in their worlds to value nature and future generations more than profits and power. Alec sued the federal government in 2011 over its failure to take action on climate change based on the public trust doctrine, under which the state serves as trustee of the commons on behalf of present and future generations. Two other teens who got involved in the campaign as youth council leaders and plaintiffs in the lawsuit are Alec's twin cousins, 17-year-old Garrett and Grant Sarles. They both participated in the recent July Walk for Our Grandchildren, a climate action where activists of all ages marched 100 miles from Camp David in Maryland to the White House, calling on President Obama to deny a permit for the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, which would bring dirty tar sands oil south from Canada to Texas refineries. Participants in the walk also called more generally for keeping fossil fuels in the ground and other measures to reduce the global rise in carbon dioxide. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who participated in the July walk, interviewed Garrett Sarles just before a rally in front of the White House at which he spoke. Here he talks about the lawsuit and other actions the I Matter campaign of Kids vs. Global Warming has undertaken.
I got involved from my cousin. He's the one who started the organization. And so my family has been involved for ever since the beginning. And so Grant and I, during the time, wanted to do something in our community in Virginia.
And that's your twin brother?
Yes, my twin brother, Grant. And we moved from California to Virginia. And while we were in Virginia, we wanted to get involved somehow. And so we joined the I Matter Youth Council, which is a way all youth can stay connected through email, phone calls, and Skypes, and so we can all talk to each other and update each other on what we've been doing locally in our communities, either by petitions or by doing slap polls, which is sea level awareness projects, and they're polls that you put on the coastlines of the beach to tell you that you will be underwater at this level. So we do that, or by telling each other we've sent letters to our representatives or to our governors or our mayors, and that is how we stay connected through what is called the I Matter Youth Council. And so Grant and I got involved by starting a march in our area.
And what was the focus of the march?
Focus of the march was to raise awareness on the day that the lawsuit was filed on May 8th, 2011. And so the march, there are marches all around the globe, actually, some in Japan, some in Egypt, some in other places in Africa as well. In all 49 states except Hawaii. And so Grant and I are the ones leading the march in our local town, Harrisonburg, Virginia.
This lawsuit, it was filed by a very young person who was your cousin a few years ago. Tell us about this.
The lawsuit was filed in California, and then the lawsuit, they said in California, was too big. It was too big for the area, and so they moved it to D.C. Grant, my twin, and myself, and my cousin, and two others from California are plaintiffs on the federal lawsuit. And the lawsuit is asking for an 8% reduction on carbon emissions per year. The percent increases per year, and it was filed in 2011, so that was at 6%, and in 2012, 7, and now we're in 2013, so it's 8. And now that the parts per million has raised up to 400 ppm in the past couple months, parts per million, it's going to start increasing more than it will in 1 year. And so that is one thing that our lawsuit is asking for. Also is massive reforestation, and also for the atmosphere to be a part of the public trust doctrine. And that is a sovereignty that the federal government uses as policies. Our lawsuit is asking for the atmosphere to be, I guess, under watch, to be under control, and so we can not pollute as much.
That sounds like good policy prescriptions, but you're actually suing the government. Who exactly does the lawsuit focus on?
The lawsuit focuses on the federal government, the EPA, and I'm not really sure all the other.
Is it against the executive, though, which the EPA is part of, or is it Congress involved?
It's the Department of Agriculture, the EPA, the Department of Energy, the Department of Commerce, other ones I cannot remember.
But it's all executive.
It is all executive, that's correct, yes.
And just tell us what's happened so far since the lawsuit was filed.
When the lawsuit was filed, during our hearing, we figured out that the National Association of Manufacturers, which is the broad corporations of all oil, gas, coal, fossil fuel consuming corporations, and they are the leading reason. And so they intervened in our lawsuit. And so they wanted to stop us and saying, you know, you can't do this. And so they intervened in our lawsuit, and it was the National Association of Manufacturers versus the Amateur Youth. And so they saw us as taking away their power and taking away their jobs. And we want to do, in fact, the opposite. We said we wanted to provide a tool to help raise awareness, but we are changing that language to we are wanting to provide more awareness and to like start an awakening to show people that our future actually is at stake and that we do matter. Our message is that our future matters. And so during the hearing, our lawsuit was dismissed due to a basis found that it was not constitutional. We partnered with a nonprofit called Our Children's Trust, and those are our attorneys, and they work pro bono, they work for free for the passion and love of the youth and for fighting for our future and their future and their grandchildren's future and future generations as well. And so our lawsuit was dismissed. And then a couple months later, our attorneys filed a motion to reconsider. We just heard recently that was dismissed. So now we are going to the D.C. Court of Appeals.
That was Garrett Sarles of the Kids versus Global Warming campaign. Find more information on the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.